Right, today is the 26th of November 2014. Cliff King of Selwyn Road, Havelock North, in the life and times of his family and himself to this point today. Cliff, would you like to just start the story off about where your family came from and so forth?
Certainly, Frank. My father was a Yorkshireman, born in Scarborough, 1907, very much a Yorkshireman, descended from the Vikings, and we were told that our name King actually comes from the Viking, as they invaded the northeast of England hundreds of years ago. He's descended from a family of cement makers. They had that for generations. Dad was, after the rigors of the First World War were pretty horrendous on the Midlands, and Dad emigrated to New Zealand aged 18 in 1926. As an 18-year-old boy, he, along with others, including some very celebrated Auckland people who became very celebrated Auckland businessmen who founded the breweries, Lion Nathan's, and Sir Robert Kerridge, and others, came out on that assisted immigrant scheme. So as boys, they arrived in New Zealand on the Tainui in 1926, worked on dairy farms, went through the Depression, lived in men's camps and making roads and what have you, married my mother, who was then a third-generation New Zealander from Scotland, from Whanganui. They were farming people. Her father was in fact the headmaster of the Awakuni High School, and a Thomas Arthur Blythe, very respected member of that community, and to this day there are a number of tracks and huts named after him for his pioneering work, sort of climbing the mountain and New Zealand ski champion and things of that nature. So mum and dad got married in 34, had their first son, my older brother, in 36, and our second son in 38, and then dad went off to the war. And he was in the RNZAF as a flying officer, navigator, did time mostly in the Pacific. I was born obviously during a furlough, or 9 months after a furlough back in New Zealand in 1943 as the third son, and grew up in Wellington. Dad was lucky to receive a soldier assistance, returned soldier assistance, to get establish a business of importing materials from Yorkshire, where he originally from, and German silks. And Richard King and Co. was the company, which later my elder brother took over from Dad, Peter. And we grew up as boys, living next door to the Kandala School. Went to Nelson College because, as a lot of military sons of military people, Nelson was a public school at the time, still is, but very much a military school where attention was given to marching and shooting and Friday afternoons.
And discipline.
Discipline. The values that had trained our parents and their parents were instilled into us at Nelson College. And we did dumbbells in the morning and swang clubs and before breakfast did calisthenics, in addition to the normal school routine. It was a school that prided itself on turning boys into men. And I suppose it did for me. So I went there in 1956 and left in 1960 with a school certificate and a university entrance, which I was probably not that academically inclined to. Fortunate to get it when I think about it, but I did have a strong work instinct instilled to me by the school.
Sure. Sports?
Well, yeah, I was always pretty outdoorish. We all were. Yes, I played rugby throughout my school years. Played for the first 15. Didn't play in the tournament. I was injured. One of the key things which the school prided itself on then was the quadrangular tournament for rugby. And a number of my friends subsequently from Wanganui Collegiate and Christ and a couple of reprobates from Wellington College remind me that I wasn't really a particularly good rugby player if I didn't play in the quadrangular tournament, so I can't claim that. But very keen. I was a junior and intermediate tennis champion and a runner-up for the senior. No, I wasn't the runner-up for the badminton. I was runner-up in the doubles for the senior championships. To Colin Chandler, who happens to live locally.
Good Lord, is that right?
And, yeah, Colin was a very good tennis player, a gymnast. Yeah.
Yes.
But most sporting interests at that young age were sort of had to have a really strong physical aspect to them to be of interest. And it wasn't a chess player, and but if you had to win a running race for the school championships, well, you bloody did.
Yes.
You know, you did what was necessary.
That's right.
But
yeah,
if it came to cross country or something pretty boring, then on, well, usually a spectator from the rear.
Yes, so Nelson would have been a pretty quiet place to have been at school in, was it?
Sleepy Hollow?
Yes.
Well, they were still recovering from the fact that their railway was never built.
That's right, yes.
And yes, a very insular little province. Then, and probably still now in its own little way, but very nice values Nelson people have, and I visit there occasionally from time to time now, and it's nice to observe the subtleties of the Nelson province still exist in the people. They're gentle people, they're not assertive people, very protective of their environment, nice orcharding base, tobacco growing and horticulture with more likely the wine industry, of course, but we spent our spare time picking up tomatoes and fruit and things to earn money, so part of our education really was outdoors. I remember one occasion we got accredited for a university entrance, four of us, and for a bet we got on our bikes at 2 o'clock or 10 o'clock at night, whenever it was, and we rode over to Mochiwaka and back in the nude. I mean, it's hard to credit, isn't it? But Peter Hogg and myself, well, as fate would have it, we were just coming back through Richmond, racing like hell to get back in time because we could sort of see the first shafts of daylight appearing, and who should come hurtling past us with this big fat slob of on his motorbike, who turned out to be our house tutor.
Oh, you're joking.
God. Well, so we were kind of sprung. But he didn't say anything for 2 or 3 days, and then he quietly got us and came, the three of us, four of us came as well.
He let you sweat a bit.
Yes, yeah, because he knew that we knew. And so it was, well, you can wear the clothes that you had on when you were biking, boys, but you're going to get six of the best. But he did let us put our underpants on. So Nelson was a good experience for all three King brothers. We were nicknamed Wrinkle because of a caning incident that my elder brother had. He was observed to have wrinkle bum after he's been caned, and so he was called Wrinkle Bum.
Oh dear.
Blythe, his younger brother, my brother, Nick's brother, was called Wrinkle 2, and I was Wrinkle 3.
Wrinkle 3.
And I still am called Wrinkle by school friends.
Ex-school
friends, yes.
Good Lord.
Yes, 55 years later.
Yes, yes.
So that was Nelson.
Yes.
Left school without too many jets in life. I loved the outdoors. My father had bought a ketch. They still lived in Wellington, but moved to Auckland in my last year of school at Nelson. Mum and Dad moved to Auckland, and he took his ketch with him. I had sailed all round the Sounds in this ketch during holidays and weekends, And of course, when it moved to Auckland, we sailed to various offshore islands around New Zealand and had some wonderful experiences watching the tuna fishermen at 4 a.m. at dawn catching tuna sort of 100 miles off the coast.
Yes.
Just, yeah, quite astonishing. And so I loved all this freedom and the notion of actually having a career of some profession held no appeal. It was generally understood that I'd go into Dad's business, which my brother had done. My next brother had become a lawyer. But Mum was always at me to go into farming because that was her background.
Certainly.
And I had stayed with farmers up in the Whanganui district of Upakanaru and enjoyed the freedom that farming offered. So it was arranged with a mate that we would go down and cut some scrub from about the 12th of December when school finished through until early February when I was to start get a job. And we went to Hicks Bay and up the end of this Pākehā Valley, which went for miles and miles through Gunga country, and finally got to the Hindmarsh family who were our, he was the boss, Tunny, little short aggressive man, and his wife, lovely lady, world expert in camellias. So we spent the next 2 months living in a camp under canvas down the river, cutting kānuka with an axe, and we cleared between the three of us about 40-odd acres. It was wonderful, catching pigs and chasing deer and tickling trout and doing everything. But we had blisters on our hands to prove that we'd done something. But we didn't make any money because Tunny turned out to be quite a miserly payer, and we sort of arrived back in Auckland and with not too many pounds shillings and pence in our pocket, but I did have enough. I had £40 because I remember looking at buying a Model T, a car, and Dad sort of frowned and said, "Oh, you'll be broke forever if you spend it on that." So we didn't buy that car, and I've regretted it ever since. But what I did take home from that, much more, infinitely more value than the £40, was the notion that I would become a farmer. Come hell or high water, I wanted to be like McAllen.
So a taste for freedom.
Hindmarsh and a few more of these guys on their horse with their dogs and the freedom of the day to execute whatever they wanted to had to do. Didn't know anything about livestock at that point. But this. So I secured a job for a farmer, Hazel Lane, at Ngātapa in Gisborne, similar hills, but much, much closer to Gisborne. When we were scrub cutting up the coast, it was pretty wild and woolly. We sort of go to the pub, I mean, age, what, 17 or 18 or something, go down to the pub at Te Aroa, Dick Richardson's pub. I'd be trying to court his daughter, Sky Richardson. She was real sweet at that one, and we weren't really supposed to be there anyway, so we'd have a jug of beer, and then I'd go down the beach with Di, and then it'd be Max's turn, and then it was our next scrub. There's three of us were in this gang of scrub cutters, and so we each had to take turns with Di. And did you get a cuddle? No. I got a kiss, did you? Oh, you're lying bastard. You never did. So all this kind of bullshit went on.
Yes.
So that then took us into the farming 12 months where I was really taught by a wonderful, wonderful returned soldier farmer how to do things, how to kill a sheep, how to catch a horse, how to look after your bridle, how to shoe a horse, what your heifers had to be, where your hoggets should be grazing, where they shouldn't, how to strain a fence, all the hand tools of basics of a farm, hill country farm. And what wonderful tutelage that turned out to be. In fact, this morning I've just been straining up some sail on for Richard, using exactly the same gear that Hazel taught me to use 55 years ago. So that was a great year, and Hazel encouraged me to apply for a scholarship to go to Lincoln College, which I really wasn't interested in. And so he applied without telling me. And then at this stage I bought a motorbike and I couldn't ride the bloody thing. I'd fall off and I never had any decent clothes because you always feel like falling off and getting grease stains all over your pants. And oh shit. I remember going to a ball one night taking Reese Allen's daughter on the back of the, turned up at the house to take Di to the Ngātapa Rugby Club ball, which was really just a shambles. But however, Reese took one look at me and said, "You can't get it and take my daughter out looking like that." So he took me upstairs and put me into a dinner jacket.
Oh, it must be.
Pants and everything, and said, "Right, off you go, young chap." Well, it was all sort of going pretty good, really, except the ball turned out to be what your first ball does. And anyway, it's kind of a long story short. Reese's son, David, we were all putting a scrum down or something, and he ripped the arm off his old man's dinner jacket, which I had on. So, oh, God, I was pretty, this isn't going to be good for future relationship with David. I thought it was a huge joke anyway. But we sort of went home on the motorbike, and she ripped a dress sort of on a bit of the gorse heads that we kind of got tangled up with going down past the hospital.
Yes.
And we both... So I ended up staying with the boys in the garage, and I remember waking up seeing this dinner jacket staring. I can still see it hanging up on the coat hanger without a sleeve, and we didn't know where the sleeve was. God, so I had to go back to the rugby club. Under the gorses. No, it wasn't there. Well, David had it stuffed into the back of his pocket, so we sort of. I can't recall the outcome, but I do remember it being pretty... that was one highlight of the year in Gisborne. And I had my first little herding dog in Hunterway, and Hazel taught me how to work a dog, how sheep should be treated, how dogs should be treated. And it was a wonderful year. And then these three men turned up one afternoon and interviewed me for something I had no idea about.
I can imagine.
And then I was told it was a rural field cadetship, which didn't mean too much to me, but a friend of my brother's, Guy Ashton, had been a rural field cadet 6 or 7 years earlier. And it became clear that from Guy telling Mum and Dad that Clifford should pursue this. So I got selected to the final interviews in Wellington, and there was one small incident occurred there which was rather amusing. But Veronica, or name began with B, was the secretary, and I was sitting there waiting for my turn and talking to this girl, and she was sort of doing the things and looking up at me all the time. And I said, "Well, where do you have lunch around here?" So, to cut a long story short, and then we went and had lunch together. But I was the last interviewed before lunch, so that was all right. The interview did what interviews do, I suppose.
Mm.
And I came out, and she took me around the corner and lunch and came. I was sitting down this little coffee shop and having a sandwich and stuff, and then she'd walk the three guys that had just interviewed me. Well, shit, of all the bloody places in Wellington that they should go for lunch, it happened to be right at the table, right next door to where I'm sitting, with the green slouch hat on and the Gisborne cowboy boots looking the part, having got off the train that morning. Thought, oh, well, that's the end of that enterprise. He's not going to be too impressed with me pitching his secretary for lunch. But he did. Vince McLean was his name, and Het King, and they were icon administrator servants to New Zealand's agriculture, and that rural field cadet scheme became famous and for producing the likes of Wilson Winneray and Kelvin Tremaine and many other successful business people and sportsmen were selected on that same process that I had been through, and I was picked with 15 other boys to undergo training at Lincoln, which included 2 years practical experience, one on a sheep farm, which I had just completed. One, I was then went down to Southland and worked on an intensive sheep and cropping farm, sowed bags of barley, wheat and oats all summer, and then went to Lincoln and did a diploma in agriculture, followed by 6 months on a dairy farm, which is where the field days are now held in Hamilton, and another year at Lincoln, followed by the valuation of farm management, and farm management diploma, VFM, which was hugely popular with the civil service for the next 25 years. Mm-hmm. All the successful, many of the successful people in the civil service had this, had either a degree in agricultural science or a VFM. Mm-hmm. And the value to them was that these were boys who had had some practical experience. They weren't just university graduates. Mm-hmm. And because we were sort of hand-picked to a degree, a number of us had a bit of enterprise, didn't really see a future career with the civil service forever, but we were bound to them for 5 years. I completed 3 of those 5 years and then had to buy my way out of that. However, they were highlight years, the years at Lincoln, because here was, you know, country boys thrown into a university situation or an agricultural college, as Lincoln then was, just looking for trouble.
Yes.
And we were good at finding it. And this is where I really started to get a bit keen about playing rugby and playing representative rugby and, you know, winning a drinking blue, which I still have, and you know, competing in Easter tournament at rowing, and yeah, it was pretty physical. And Lincoln is, well, how do you describe Lincoln? It comprised really of 2 years of just social activity with guys having marvellous time terrorising the nurses' home, the Carlton and the dental nurses, and going off to Easter tournaments and things. And then a very, very intensive final year for this VFM, which is still regarded by certainly those who endured it as it stretched every single individual to the limit. We would be working at our desks until 2 and 3 in the morning completing field tests, and then it was very intensive. But it made us who we became, and it taught us the professional, our professional ethic in the way that a lawyer, an accountant, or a surveyor, an engineer, we had a professional ethic instilled into us to deal with farmers and interview them as to their, the nature of their farming activity, and be able to do their budgets and value their assets and etc. So that was kind of the education phase of my life. But right at the death knell of completing it, I met Jan. And Jan was the daughter of a very prominent Christchurch family, the MacPhails, who were a clan rather than a family, because there were sort of several brothers that had all been in the war. They'd all achieved sporting pinnacles. Her uncle was an All Black selector at the time. Father was the chairman of the rugby union, the chairman of the Victory Park Board, a decorated soldier. Neil was a returned prisoner of war, and these men were men. They were men with distinguished records in their own world. And so I was reluctantly, as a North Islander, regarded rather sceptically in this situation, sort of taking their little Jan out and promptly drinking all the milk at the mailbox before you left. However, we became engaged and married in April 1966, at which point I had been assigned to work in Rotorua for the Lands and Survey Department. Graduated one day, married the next. Honeymoon in the back country of high country, and then up into Quail Bay in the Sounds, where I discovered that the girl that I'd married didn't have a clue how to cook mussels or flounders or
scallops
or fish or anything. All the things that I mean were pretty important to me. So, that was interesting. And she probably discovered all my faults too. So that was kind of the end of my single days, or our single days.
Yes, yes.
And we began our life together in Rotorua. Me as a field officer for the Lands and Survey Department, doing budgets for returned soldiers at Waikiki and Taupo and Whakatane. And Jan as a staff sister at the Rotorua Hospital, and making clothes, doing sewing and raising, earning money. And in my spare time, myself and David Smythe bought a tractor, and we'd go up to Mamaku and pull pungas out of the bush and sell them for sixpence a foot. And we sold thousands and thousands of pungas. We used to borrow Dennis Ganey's truck and deliver them on the weekend and be paid cash. And this was all with the objective of getting a deposit so that we could put in for a ballot farm. Very focused at this stage in going farming. I played rugby, but rugby was always second. I played for Rotorua and Oldwater, sat on the bench for Bay of Plenty for a couple of games. But this was all with an objective, getting our own farm. And Mum and Dad didn't have the resources, and nor did the McPhails. It was a case of do it yourself, so we said to. And the panga was the key to it. So we worked hard, but it was good for me because it toughened up a student and gave him a strong back and a strong... And I guess one recollection of that, we got this contract to build a beer garden at Wairahi Tourist Resort. It was a big beer garden, and the pungas got stood up and made walls all around the little alcoves here then. And it was worth about £1,000. Might have been £1,200. It was pounds anyway. And we cut all these things, got them all cut to length, took the truck down, and then we got the football club to come down on Saturday morning, and we're going to put this whole thing up in the morning.
Yes.
There's two of us, pretty much the whole team. And sure enough, we strained up the bottoms, pulled all the fingers tight together, strained the top, filled the trench, and stood the fingers up. Collected the 1,000 or 1,200 quid and went home. Played Walker in the afternoon, gave him a bloody good hiding too, as I recall, because we were all kind of psyched up and physical with all this rushing around. And everybody sort of looked at everyone and said, "Well, where's that 1,000 quid? We better put it on the Barra Bridge." And Walker, Manny and Pato Voice, and Karen, Denny, Murray, and others, we sort of, why don't we do that? They always would entertain us after a game, and we'd go up to their club rooms at Waka, and Howard Morrison and Kirby singing, and we'd have a really good night with a decent hangi and plenty of music, and this had always gone on. So we said, well, it's our turn, you come down to our club rooms, but which we down at Rugby Park, and pretty boring, and a hot pool, and it was about it, and all that ever happened is your son got chucked in the pool. So we said, now come to Brent's room, we're going to the taking over the private bar at Brent's. Well, the 1,000 quid went that night, and what a good night it was too, and remembered by all. And but nonetheless, the dollars kept stacking up in the background. We'd bought our little house at Nongatown, we'd done it up, but time came, the ballot farms were issued, and I put in for one or two. I was a bit cautious about the quality because I was doing budgets for marginal lands farmers and returned soldiers, which was the last line of lending. You quickly developed an appreciation for what were the successful ingredients necessary to be a successful farmer. And a big part of that was having the right farm. And so when we came to appraising our own future and what farms we would put in for and what ones we wouldn't, I was pretty fussy on the criteria. However, to sort of cut a long story short, we missed out on our ballot opportunities in the first year that we put in. We didn't get selected. But those farms did very well down at Tahakuri and one in Gisborne. I chose not to put in for the farms at Tiana or Tapa. They were just a bit small. When the second year came round, the government changed the rules and said, well, these ballot farms are for farming boys, shepherds, managers, they're not for field officers, people like yourself. And that was a complete shock to me. So I resigned the job immediately and took up a job managing 3,000 acres at Reparoa, and then went and saw the Minister of Lands, Duncan McIntyre, and said, if you'd told me a year ago that I had to have a year's experience, I'd have done it then. I had to pay 500 or 1,000 odd, it was getting around to dollars at this stage, to buy my way out of my bond. And so I demonstrated a commitment, and they gave me dispensation to get into that next ballot, which we were so fortunate to win our farm, number 6, and for a deposit of $11,500, we got 800 acres at Pootree in northern Hawke's Bay. It was a farm which was $60,000 all up, land, buildings, stock and plant. We had our $11,000. We had a leasehold in the first year, so we had a mortgage of $44,000 and the freehold, if we wanted it, was a further $6,000, I think. So here we are with our Volkswagen, and an hour and a half off the main road of Grauphunga on a very windy gravel road with no power, no phone, and 17 gates to get the mail once a week. And 800 acres in 5 paddocks. A new house, built in a ridiculous position, stuck on a ridge. A wool shed, no yards, and no holding paddocks. So it was roll your sleeves up and get into it. Power came some time later. We put our own phone in for the first year, along with our neighbours, Owen Costley and Ian Brickle and Peter Beddingfield. And basically got stuck in. It was a hell of a good farm. It was a third pumice, a third papa, and a third limestone. The most perfect little farm, one-man farm, you could really dream of for that contour. It all faced north. There wasn't a water trough on the paddock. Every paddock had a limestone spring or a stream through it. The stock were very healthy. It had been the clearing of a station which I later wrote the history about, or recorded the history, I should say, I didn't write it, I recorded it. And this particular 800 acres was the early country of about 7,000 acres where the stock would congregate in the spring, in the late winter and early spring. So it had a fertility and a microclimate about it which suited cattle and sheep.
Sure.
And we did well. We did exceptionally well. We had 5 inches of rain every month for 10 years, give or take an inch.
Good Lord.
Unbelievable. And our $44,000 mortgage we paid off $4,000 the first year, $6,000 the second year. And the third year, I forget what we paid off. It might have been $6,000 or $8,000, but we also bought another farm. And we shifted the house. We cut the house in half, prepared another house site lower down on the farm and more sheltered. And it really became our home for life at this point because it was humming. Cattle prices had gone well, sheep prices had lifted, wool prices were still strong. It was a very, very good period to be farming. And we had a farm with a very, very low cost structure. And we were able, through a very benign climate and a lot of clover in the country, because it was sort of reasonably new, that everything just fattened quickly. I think we topped the weaner fair for 6 out of 10 years. Adopted some very, at the time, then new management techniques. We calved our heifers in one cycle in June and our cows in one cycle in July. And so we had really good beefy weaners to sell with big dewlaps and strong coats because of the limestone water. The buyers really chased our cattle. And likewise with the sheep, because we were able to get good lambing percentage from crossbreeding the Romneys with the Bull Leicester to keep the first cross, having a high lambing percentage in excess of 120 enabled us to keep all the ewe lambs. And basically 40%, after about 3 or 4 years, 40% of the flock were two-tooths that don't die and had reliable lambing. We didn't have lamb hoggets. So it was about 40% were four-tooths and 20% were six-tooths. So we were selling genuine four-year-old ewes at a death rate of 2 or 3%. High wool weights because they were all young sheep.
Yes.
Easy to muster because they were all first cross. Flappy raincoat really, and the day it was done. And very healthy sheep, which enabled me to sort of go and buy another farm close to Wairoa, where we envisaged we would later go and live, close to schooling, etc. Which was two dairy farms. And that we just used for buying in bullocks and fattening them for the butchers in Wairoa. We didn't ever go and live there as it turned out, but it did give me some flexibility with our livestock policies at home at Waikoe. And we had a philosophy there of running as fewer ewes as I could. I only wanted 2,000 lambs. And so we were settled with 1,600 ewes and 160 cows. And we built our 1,600 ewes up to 2,000 ewes. And then getting far too many lambs. So I cut the ewes back to sort of 1,800, 1,600, 1,400. So I was getting my 2,000 lambs. And I got down to about 1,280-something ewes, still doing my 2,000 lambs.
Yes.
And, of course, that farm was so efficient.
Mm.
Sheep were always fat.
Yes, yes.
I had so much flexibility. Reliable rainfall. It was simple and profitable. So they were really, I'd have to say, the most productive years of our life. Jan was busy with our young family. Cameron was born. Sarah had been born 6 months prior to us going to the farm. She was born in Rotorua. And Cameron was born 18 months after we got to the farm. And Richard 2 years after that. And it was a district. Pootree was a district which became our lives. It was an empty valley that had been a First World War soldier settlement, and the remnants were largely gone, and the Crown had bought, the Lands and Survey had bought two big stations and redeveloped them and was settling young farmers such as ourselves. and the school was there catering for about 16 or 18 people. Well, that quickly grew to sort of double to 35, to a two-teacher school. And the valley fell into sort of two halves. The older families who'd been there and these young, fresh outsiders who knew
yes,
it all.
Yes.
And there was a lot of tension, and it usually surfaced at the school. Poor school, we had good school teachers. And we played hard, we worked hard, we played hard. When there was an argument, it was a bloody big argument, but
yes.
Quickly you got over it and you got on with having a party. And that's backcountry life.
Yes.
And there's just so, the imprint is indelible on, I recognise it to this day, people who've lived in the backcountry.
Mm.
There's something about them.
Sure.
That I just identify with, and Jan does too, whether it's the deprivation or the hardship you'd gone through, or the lack of social contact, or the commitment, or the fact you had to dock in a gale, or what it was. But being a backcountry person meant you didn't get to the pictures. Our children probably didn't go to the pictures once every 2 years if they were lucky.
Sure.
They didn't play in football teams and sports teams because there wasn't enough of them. And if they did, the girls would be in the front row. And
because, you know, as young Mary going to Te Puteri, it must have been quite an adjustment for a while.
Huge culture shock.
Mm.
Our nearest neighbour was 3 miles away, and there was 8 gates.
Mm.
And they weren't... They weren't our age, they were 15, 20 years older than we were. There were a lot of Maori shepherds, and consistent with the Lands and Survey Department, we got on well with the community. But we were lonely. Jan was tremendous the way she... I had my farm to concern myself with, and Jan had young children, but she was tremendous in those years, the way she sort of... Mother had died, and then her father had died, and for a girl that had been brought up in such a close Pendleton community of Christchurch,
sure, yeah,
to endure that loneliness, and it was always, well, I was indebted to Jan's sacrifice, and that came out 10 years later when we started to make some decisions to correct that part of life, shortcomings. But for the 10 years that we were there and loving it, it was different. It was so different.
Mm-hmm.
And the stories and the experiences, some of them were just hilarious.
Yes.
And it was during that period that the school had a 75-year reunion. And as part of that, the district commissioned me to record the history of the stations and the school. So we had, as you do in the backcountry, put together a committee, and somebody did this and somebody did that, and so-and-so organised the day, and my job was to get down all the historical records from all the old families of who was there then and what now. And that was a most insightful experience for me, because suddenly I was looking at the history of something that I knew very well in today's terms, but here I was studying what it was 75 and 100 years ago.
Mm.
The same roads, the same paddocks,
yeah,
different technology, still farming. How did they do it then? Why did they do it now? And that made a complete man out of me, because suddenly I understood where we kind of fitted in into the span of life. When you start looking back over three generations,
yes, yes,
and think, why did he put that crossing in there? Or why did they shift the school from, when I mean it could have been so easily been over there by the orchard. And so those sorts of little things which taken in a total form over a 40,000 acre valley.
Yes.
It became apparent to me that change was happening and would continue to happen.
Mm.
Although it hadn't happened while we were there,
yes.
Well, I hadn't observed it happening, in fact it was. Mm. And there was all sorts of changes rolling around in commerce, in farming, in New Zealand, in social things changing. But here we were in our little time capsule in the backcountry, completely oblivious of it all. So, well, I took on a new view of who we were and what we could achieve in our lifetime and what were our skill sets to adapt and change. We, at the age of 25, we'd achieved our ambition to own our own farm. At the age of 28, we had a couple more farms than they were matting. And did I want to be docking in the same place for the next 40 years? Did I want to own a whole lot more land? Not really. I'd had an efficient little business. But did I want more social opportunities and sporting opportunities for my children? Well, that was a definite yes. Did I want to see Jan enjoying more female company other than the 12 families that she engaged with, was only there to engage with? So that started me thinking on the next step and the next chapter in our life, and the involvement that, and the commitment that that would take, and why was I doing, why would we be doing it? And it was difficult to explain to Jan. Having dragged her in there by her hair, I now had twice the task of taking her away from her home,
yes.
And all of the newly established friendships and everything, just to begin a new life with people that we didn't know. And we looked at Gisborne, and I was imbued with the idea of establishing a business that could earn some money without me,
yes.
So that it could run itself. And I only knew agriculture and farming, but this kiwi fruit thing looked to be a pretty successful thing. And so we looked at the Bay of Plenty and buying some land and developing a big block, which I could then retire back from and resume livestock farming, because that's what I was good at. And we go and live in Gisborne. Well, first of all, it was the Bay of Plenty, but Dan quickly scotched that and said, no, she didn't want to live with the humidity in the. We didn't perceive the Bay of Plenty as having a fibre in its community in the way that the East Coast townships do. So Gisborne was the second choice, and we lined up a farm to buy and an orchard land to do. And then I missed out on the option of the farm. So we looked again at Hawke's Bay and Havelock North, where we acknowledged that we were, one of the main reasons we were moving was for schooling, and of course we're better for schooling than in Havelock North.
Sure.
And we're better for a nice stable future than for Jan and us as a family than Havelock North. There was plenty of horticultural potential, there was wonderful farming opportunities, so it became real. We sold the farm for $200,000 to a pig hunter who was the son of the local chairman of the catchment board, Eric Batson. Brian bought our farm.
Oh, lovely. So you knew Brian well, and Eric.
Yep. And Brian wasn't really, didn't pursue the same livestock policies that we did. He stacked on a lot of sheep. And at about that time, the climate changed and became quite dry for the next 10 or 15 years. And the pumice element of that country meant that when it got dry, it takes a long time to recover.
Yeah, sure. Mm.
Limestone in the parka was fine, but if you're stocking it a bit heavily, so they didn't enjoy quite the prosperity that we had. So, but I still go back to the farm every year in the autumn. It's been subsequently bought by the Brickell family, And Ian, young Ian Brickley, is farming it now as a good, conscientious little farmer. He's like his father is. Good boy, good stockman. Mm. And it gives me great pleasure to see the farm looking well again.
Yes.
And all the trees that we planted they're all great big oak trees and elm trees, and it's lovely now. It was pretty bleak in those days when we went there, with the pumice flying everywhere and
having no yards and no this and no that.
That's right. No, we fenced it all up, put in a new set of yards down the middle of the farm. It was a piece of cake by the time we left it. And the advent of motorbikes, of course, in the early years it was a horse.
That's right, yes.
And in the 1st of September 1969, I was coming back on a lambing beat and fell off the horse at a gateway for some reason, don't know what happened. I got kicked in the face and dragged by the horse and had a fractured spine. And so that was pretty traumatic for Jan. Fortunately, I had a healing bitch which licked all my face wound. Face and jaw was all busted, teeth were knocked out. But she cleaned the wound up, licking me, and I couldn't see, I was blind. And I remember hanging on to Ben's collar and sort of just walking, staggering up the track to where we lived, which is probably 300 or 400 feet further up high. Mm.
Sure.
And Jan sort of realised it was late anyway, so she got me in the hospital and we sort of came right. But it's really only just about 3 or 4 weeks ago that I got some teeth capped, and I really can say I've got a nice jaw again, and I feel confident.
Your smile's better again.
All my life I've had lived with this very numb sort of bottom lip, and
yes,
as a result of that horse accident. But that was just exhaustion and, you know, working too hard. And
sure.
Going in to play rugby in Warra just to meet some guys twice
yes.
a week.
Yes.
2 hours into town, 2 hours home again.
So no back problems since?
No. I can thank the pungas for that. I've been very lucky to have strong legs and a strong back.
Mm.
And I think it was just all that lifting and pungas at an age when all your muscles are sort of building. The body's looked after me.
Yes, well, you know, they always say that your back is held together by your stomach muscles, and your spine is also held together by the strength of your back muscles.
Yes.
And of course your legs are a result of being able to do the work with the rest of your body. So no, that's quite logical really, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, well, I think I know I've got a stronger back and legs than either of my sons.
Mm.
And it's only really and David Smythe, who worked with me, David too, he's still a close friend. David still says, you know, he's blessed with good strong legs and a good strong back. So there you are, young ones, if you want to enjoy
some pungas.
A good skeetle frame, don't forget pungas.
Yes.
Anyway, so that kind of brought us into the next phase of our life. But we had become Wairoa people. We had earned our respect around Wairoa because we were good at things that we set out to do. We set out to do well, properly, I should say, and that was kind of our legacy. We still have a number of friends in Wairoa, and I subsequently spent 10 years as a director of the county council's roading local authority trading enterprise, LATE it's called.
Yes.
QRS, and that's kept me in touch with the district and its roading infrastructure and the people. And we, of course, built ourselves a nice batch up of mahi, which we all use quite regularly. So it's nice to see people you know, and it's nice to be known locally.
Yes.
I like small towns. It's something that, if you've lived in a small town in backcountry New Zealand, it never leaves you. this eye for detail in a small community, and the ability to appreciate the individuals in it as being different and having the right to be different.
Yes. Well, in this interviewing people, Cliff, I've noticed that some of these people I'm interviewing are in their mid-90s, late-90s, and it's amazing. They all know one another, and yet they were not in the same area. But all of a sudden I realised that all these villages were small. There were only a tenth of the people anywhere at that stage. Of course they would all know one another.
Well, you know, they're sisters and they're cousins.
That's right.
And that's the linkage. Mm. You know, so and so's mother's coming to stay. Oh, yes, well, she was a Williams, you know. And
that's right.
And her brother married so and so Lowry.
That's
right. Oh, yeah. I see. So they're brother and cousins. And so, you appreciated all those. Mm. And that, in my life, came out very much in the next 10 years of our life when I started the Rural Property Trust. And buying farms and having all these, having this understanding of small communities became paramount in being accepted in the wider farming community for someone who had judgment and who understood the subtleties of a farming community. I know the Wirral was a good period in our life. And we still renew it every time we go back up to Mahia with a bit of fishing and to work out one.
With
friends. It's something we treasure. Well, that cup of tea has just renewed. Jan's just renewed some of our recollections of the life at Aotearoa, Te Puturi. And that really, the road was the paramount link to town. Telephone when we first went there was hand grind, working, that was our link, but very unreliable, and of course the road then became the next most important thing, and various amusing things would happen on the road. Mason Horn, our local mayor, was notorious for being able to hold a lot of alcohol and a very, very good and careful driver. But you'd quite often find him sound asleep in the middle of the road in his Falcon at different stages of the evening or early morning. And there is the occasion, recall when Mason had to jump out of his car and hop into the school bus and drive that because Marge, his wife, had been driving the school bus because Mason hadn't got home. No one ever feared for Mason's life because they knew he'd just stop the car. And he had. And Marge had to drive the school bus in the morning because it was Mason's turn, so she drove up the road until she found Mason in the car, woke him up, and Mason drove on and Marge took the car. Well, it took him a few years to live that one down.
I feel it, actually.
And then there was another occasion, I was coming home and I just got this second-hand Fairlane because it was an automatic car. And it was Bill Webbs, who was the manager of Richmond's. And it was marvellous because we had three young kids and bassinets and all the stuff that goes with it. And to be able to get in and out without changing gears was very, very big plus. And we're hooling off home after the Frasertown dog trials, which I don't know who got at. And we come sort of floating around the corner, it was a bit of a foggy night, and then wham, bam, wallop, and that makes the mob of pigs, and they were big pigs. And I was quite used to wild pigs. In fact, I think if you added the tally up, I probably killed a pig every two or three days for 10 years. Wild pigs, that's how ravaged we were with pigs. Not because I wanted to, but because the damn things were there.
Yes.
And that's the reason why Brian Batson bought the farm there, because he'd come... I'd employed him to come up and get rid of these boars that were beating the hell out of my new grass. But anyway, here I am in my new Fairlane, bumping and thumping over, and I think, oh Christ, this is going to be expensive. So I get out of the car and there's a couple of pigs writhing on one side and another one squealing down the bank and an old sow out cold. So I picked up two that were I can recall, and slung them in the boot in amongst all the groceries and everything else we'd got for the day. The kids were still asleep in the back of the car. Dragged the old sow over the side of the road and had a bit of a quick look at the front. There was no water coming out of the radiator. That was right. A bit of the grill was sort of buckled. And drove home. And just as I was coming up past the sheriff's quarters, I remembered that John Smith next door was crutching. And Willie Culshaw, the shearers from Rap and the gang, was all in the sheriff's quarters. So I thought, oh, I know what I did. So I shot in there, quietly, opened the boot, and the pig had woken up, one of the pigs had woken up, and it was kind of blinking at me, so I grabbed it, opened the shearer's quarters door, closed the door, and then knocked, and then got in the car. Just as I was getting in the car, a light flicks on, and then another light, and what the fuck's going on here? Anyway, it was the talk of the valley for a while.
I can imagine.
I chucked the other pig in Willie's truck. So he would have got a shock in the morning when he went to get in the car. To go up to the shed, and there's another bloody pig sitting there. Anyway,
oh, dear.
But those were the sort of the... It was a district of practical jokers.
Yes.
For about 3 years, we were always playing jokes on somebody else. If you went to the dog trials and it was, you know, you'd had a run and you were thinking you might go to the long drop to have a pee, you just always check that there wasn't any golden syrup on the bloody seat, because those sort of things happened.
Right? Yes.
And the other aspect of Petrie life, which was a feature really, was the music. We were blessed with the Gilbert family, who had this wonderful musical talent amongst five or six of them. Sam Hamilton had one eye. Ara to deal with the road, and he could play any instrument. Played one saxophone. His other brother played the other saxophone. Little young Willie was the drummer, but they'd all swap instruments when it suited them. There was a couple of guitarists as well. And they were good, and they were very good, and they were good at playing Maori music and all the 10 guitars.
Yes.
There was lots of sing-alongs that happened for single night parties, often ended up being all weekend affairs. The dog trials were always a lot of fun, but always finished off with wonderful music, and that was probably something that the Pootree people were terribly lucky, as distinct to other districts, who people would come in to our district knowing that we were having a party or it was somebody's 60th or 40th or whatever, and there'd be no trouble getting people to come to your party because they always knew that the Blue Moons would be there.
Well, it's interesting how flexible your transport system was, you know, when you were referring to the gentleman that died and you sent him to wire on the bus.
Did I record that?
No, you didn't.
Oh, well, Otoi was a station owned by the Lands and Survey, and Walter Neri Neri was one of their shepherds. And Walter was, as Jan related earlier, a very old-time Maori. Made all his own clothes, saddlery, shot his horse. He had good horses, Walter, good dogs. Anyway, Walter developed quite an affinity because he was trapping possums and things on the weekend up near us. And he used to borrow my tractor to get them all out because he got 430 of one night poisoning. And we got quite close to sort of helping Walter out with different things if we were going to town. And one morning, Millie, his wife, rings up and says, quite early, she says, oh, it's Walter, Kingy. She used to call me Kingy. Kingy, it's Walter, he won't wake up. And I said, do you want me to come down? Yeah, you come now. So I go down, and sure enough, here's Walter, dead as a pole, sitting up in bed, clean as anything, hasn't been scrubbed. And so what do we do now? So I said, I'll have to ring the policeman. Millie, and notify the policeman. Oh, I don't know about you, ring check. I said, it's all right, Millie, I'll deal with it. And then what the body, do we need to bring his family? Where is his family? Oh, they're Tolga Bay. Okay, well, you'll need to come with me and use our phone for the toll calls. And I'll arrange with Jack and I'll take Walter out. But I'm shearing at the moment, so I can't. I've got to be at the shed, back at the shed by sort of count out time at 7 or 9 or whenever the time was. So she dresses Walter up, and here he is sitting there in his lovely homespun knit jersey and everything, complete with his hat on and everything. So I sat him up in the car and put the seatbelt on him and took him out in the bog track, drove him out to Raupanga to meet Bill James, the undertaker, and Jack Wadsway, the policeman. Well, Jack had to go to Napier to a hearing, so he couldn't stay. The undertaker, Bill James, was in Whakatane, and he wasn't going to get back, so you have to take him into Wairoa. And I said, well, I can't take him into Wairoa, I've got the sheriff. So Jack had left a message, just put him on the service car, which just pulled in as I was there, to Castlenise General Store. And the three passengers get off and go and get their ice cream and things. And Wally, the driver, said, oh, shit, okay, right, well, we're quick, we'll put him in the back seat now and prop him up in the suitcase, and no one will know the difference. And I'll drop him off at the undertaker when the other passengers got off. And that's exactly what happened. And my last recollection of Walter was him sitting out in the back of the bus, something he'd never been on in his life before. And his family came down from Tolaga Bay, and about 5 days later we went up to the Tangi and buried him on top of a scrubby hill.
Yes, it had only ever happened in the back country, couldn't it?
Well, that was the way of it.
That's right, absolutely.
The aftershot of that little event was that I got asked to be a Justice of the Peace, because every district is supposed to have a JP for these sorts of events.
Yes.
If you can't get hold of the police, you've got to tell the local JP. So I've been a Justice of the Peace for nigh on 40 years.
As a result,
purely of having to take Walter out to Raupanga.
Oh, God.
However, these are the life's little twists and turns. But parties and people and good experiences, those are the recollections that I take with me to my future from those 10 years in Pootree. The farming achievements and all of the achieving all the goals and the critical things pale into insignificance, really, in the scheme of life when I think back to the happy events that occurred for us all and the character forming things that took place for us and the children.
Yes.
And that was kind of the end of that chapter. And we moved in April 1979 to Havelock North, where we had bought an old homestead that was built in the 1920s by Mr. Bell of the Bell Tea fame. And he built this lovely old home at 50 Selwyn Road that, or was it 40? It was 40 Selwyn Road. That's right, we now live at 50. He'd had TB in Dunedin, where he'd founded his tea company, and the house fire, he'd almost died of asphyxiation because his lungs were affected with TB. So they told him he had to go and live in the sanatorium for TB patients in Waipakarau or Central Otago or Queensland or somewhere very dry. Well, he came to Havelock and he built this big house, and he imported a shipload of American redwood, the real deal, because it doesn't burn. And he built this house, and we were lucky to live in it for 30 years. He had died, and the Burberrys had owned it, and there was all sorts of interesting events happened in that house as the family grew up. And one particular morning, a plumber sticks his head round the side of the garage and says, "Mr. King, can you come over here, please?" we're renovating the house next door and there's a pipe coming out from under your garage that's pouring out boiling hot water. And sure enough, there it was. And we traced the pipe and it came from the flat upstairs in the old house. And of course, what had transpired is old Mr. Burberry, when he'd lived there, he'd built a little cottage next door, also out of the remnants of this redwood. And he'd left his son-in-law live in the big house, but he had put the hot water into his new house out of the water cylinder in the old house. And for the rest of his life, he never paid a hot water bill, but his son-in-law would have paid it, not knowing.
That's right, yes.
And then Miss Twentyman lived there for 15 or 18 years, and I ended up paying her hot water bill for 10 or 15 years without ever knowing.
Yes.
So those are some of the interesting events of owning an old house.
Yes.
But, yeah, we just hopped into developing an orchard to pursue this idea of having a separate business from what I wanted to be as a farmer that would earn some money for our retirement. Without the need for me to be working it, I could get on and do the things that I wanted to do, which generally was not becoming very profitable through the 80s and early 90s. And so we bought this orchard down the Napier Road, which had pear trees that was sort of 60 and 70 years old. And it had been an old pit fruit orchard. There was a bit of stone fruit at the back, but it was a historic bend of the river next to Tommy Tanner, who was an early pioneer of Hawke's Bay and had built a magnificent homestead. This was right slap bang alongside it, and in fact had been his horse paddock. Mm. It was owned by the Flanders. Colin Flanders owned it when we went there in 1979, and we pulled out all the trees and planted all the kiwi fruit and worked like hell for 4 or 5 years. And pretty much went broke. We just couldn't make it pay. I had bought a farm down Middle Road, fortunately, which sustained us during this period and helped educate the children. But the kiwi fruit was just like having 5 mortgages all at once. So we sold it. And in fact, Jan's brother bought it, and Alistair, and he farmed it for 3 or 4 more years. And he came to the same conclusion that I'd come to. But Hardy Evans was the orchard manager, and Hardy had worked for me in Wairoa on one of the dairy farms that I bought at Awamati. And Hardy was the son of Cardo, our lawyer. And Cardo and Hardy were real characters. And I can probably illustrate Hardy. One morning we were at work at the orchard, and we had a bloke, Grant, working for us, who was a bachelor. And Hardy was a man of very, very few words. And Grant was late this particular morning, and shuffles in, it was a dead, frosty, cold morning, and you know, the sort of morning you hate picking up the pruners, but you know it's got to be done. Mm. So we're getting into our printing, and Grant waltzes in, just as Hardy's putting the jug on for morning tea. Oh, g'day, Hardy, g'day, Cliff. Sorry I'm late, I've been busy doing this, that, and the next thing. And next minute, Grant says, oh, Hardy, I saw you at the dump on Saturday. And Grant said, yeah, I saw you there, Grant. I saw you. Who was that chewy you had in the car with you? And Grant said, oh, that's Veronica. In a sort of rather an injured tone to his voice, as Grant had a new girlfriend quite frequently. And Hardy said, Veronica. Oh, yeah. Were you picking her up or dropping her off? And that was sort of Hardy's humour. And it was particularly funny because Grant was one of these people who always hung around the dump on Saturday morning getting a a new fridge boat or a set of hinges or something. You'd always come home with a boot full of something or other.
Right.
So Andy's comment about you picking her up and rubbing her up was very poignant.
Yes, I can imagine.
Well, it was the same Hardy who, 15 years later, was running the orchard for me, or with me, I should say, because I worked there most days. And then, when we sold the orchard, he moved down to the farm, down the middle road. And then later on, we helped Hardy buy his own orchard, where he still is orcharding to this day down Brookvale Road. And he's a wonderful companion and employee. I think I worked for him rather than him working for me, really. But however, he's a good friend.
Yeah.
And such was that sort of intervening period as we were educating our family. And Jan was still working at Duart Hospital. And we were full of into the life around Havelock. It was just marvellous having all this. I remember the kids coming home the first day from the primary school saying, "God, town kids are lazy, Dad." They were so used to walking the last 2 miles home and catching frogs and turning up at all hours of the evening,
a
school bag full of all sorts of things, from mushrooms to bolts that had dropped off a truck or something. As they'd walk down the road home, and suddenly here they were in suburbia and playing sport, which they all lapped up. Sarah was, they went to the intermediate, and the boys eventually went to Hereworth for a couple of years and then on to high school. Sarah went to Woodford for 2 or 3 years to try and make a lady out of this sort of wind-blown country girl. And she made some very, very good friends at Woodford, and through the quality of the education, she passed all of her exams, the school certificate and the university entrance, and was able and was selected for the nursing career at Christchurch Hospital, as her mother had been 30 years or so earlier. And Sarah enjoyed very good years living here in Havelock and with friends, that country girls that she had known prior to us moving here from up the coast.
Yes.
And subsequently still has them as her friends today.
Mm.
And sees them at Mar here. And so she later went on and did her OE. But the boys, they too enjoyed their sporting and were able to play in teams. And Cameron was the running champion, and Richard was the rugby champion, and all this sort of thing went on.
Good, yes.
As it does with, you know, young children. And we quickly got to know lots and lots of people in Hawke's Bay, which hitherto we really didn't know too many people at all. But our financial fortunes were sort of dwindling with all this private school education and Kiwifruit not doing any good. So I was forced to make a career decision to sacrifice the dream that I had with the Kiwifruit and replace it with another dream, which I had this fascination in my mind with the English system of leasing and land and tenant farming, and I wanted to know more of it. And to cut a long story short, I did quite a bit of research into it and went to Perth, where there was a model working there called the Australian Rural Property Trust, and I met the principal founders of it, a bloke called Ray Jones, and convinced them that the idea would work here in New Zealand. And Ray had come to his own conclusions about New Zealand because he had a friend at Barclays, John Percival, who likewise had sort of had shares in the Australian Trust. And so, to cut a long story short, we all conspired to set it up here. And it basically was New Zealand's first unlisted public trust.
Mm.
In 1984. And so from a life of going down to the orchard or the farm every morning at 7:30, I was suddenly consigned to getting on the 6:30 flight to Wellington and staying in a grotty little flat and helping put together this idea whereby a trust is formed and people subscribe for units in the trust, and that the manager of the trust, which was basically myself and some investors, would then invest this money and buy good farms, owning the land only. We didn't own any plant or machinery or stock. That was the land was leased immediately back to a good, reliable farming family, and in many cases the very families who we had bought the land from stayed on owning the farm, owning the stock and plant, but that instead of paying horrendously high mortgages, which at that stage had got to 16% and 18%, sure, they were paying a 5% rental to the trust.
Sure.
So this idea was conceived with a lot of care and thought, and we set some rules which kind of said, well, we're not going to do this, and we're only going to buy the best land, and we're not going to borrow a dime, we won't have a mortgage, and all these other business considerations which were designed to protect the investor. And it was a winning recipe.
Sure.
Which suddenly, on Tuesday, the 17th of October 1987, the world stock market crashed. And contrary to what most people would imagine, the Rural Property Trust at that date owned four farms, which I had bought. I bought all the farms, I carefully selected them. We had $3 or $4 million in the bank, we had no mortgage, and our investors were very secure. Their investment was worth the same today as it was yesterday.
Yeah.
And the yield would be the same. And so that stock market crash catapulted our revenue stream of investment from around about $50,000 to $100,000 a month to $1 million a month. And the trust just became hugely successful. And while this was going on, our family are at high school and I'm flying around the country. I quickly learned to use a small plane and visit 5 or 6 farms, look at them by air and land, and talk to the landowners and fly on to the next one, the next one, the next one. It was the only way I could deal with the demand from farmers for the opportunity to sell their land to the trust and become freehold in their own business. And while it was regarded very sceptically by the farming community, anything like this, of course, that separates a farmer from his land is a real threat.
Sure. Yeah.
We had a lot of credibility at stake, and we were fortunate to have Alistair McGregor and Pat Lowry, two prominent farming families, as trustee, as directors of the trust. And so that, to some degree, ameliorated the mistrust of some of the older families. And then when we started buying just the very best farms from and leasing them only to good farming families, some respect started to grow. And after 4 years, I had bought, with Lynn Williams, bought the dairy farms, and I bought the sheep and cattle and the cropping farms. After 4 years, we'd bought 60-odd farms, spent about $60 million. We still always kept 20% of the trust funds in cash, and we kept the farms freehold, and we owned 2 forests, which I bought. Each of those is a story in itself. But here was a young farmer from the back country, suddenly footing it with AMP and Tower and insurance and the BNZ and the banks and everybody else in the funds management business, which was fledgling at that stage, and everybody was calling themselves financial advisors. Well, they'd previously been car salesmen or people who couldn't be employed. They were just absolutely... And we had no more right to call ourselves credible than they did, other than we knew what we were buying, because we were farmers. And we knew about farming.
Yeah, sure.
And we didn't buy crap. And that quickly became apparent in the marketplace. We became too successful. If there was looking back, and so the predators of the financial world sort of closed in around us. Alan Hubbard bought a controlling share in the management company. I didn't want to work for Alan Hubbard, nor did Lynn, and we quickly resigned in 1990. He sold it to then to Selwyn Cushing.
Yes.
And of course, to that day, he's been sort of robbing it ever since, really. And it still exists. The farms are all still there. It's not still freehold. It's half the size that it was. But anyway, it's under... Sure. The last 20 years has been under different guidance. But I was exhausted. And I'd also, at the time, been engaged by Kerry Packer, who had bought the Australian Rural Property Trust to clean up that trust. And so I went over and reviewed the portfolio of about 200 farms, and all throughout Australia, from Oodnadatta to Mallaparinka Station. I was in Sydney every morning at 8 o'clock, every Monday morning at 8 o'clock, and then off to somewhere to look at the station, and then write a report and say, I think you should sell this and find it. So that was going on while I was still running the Rural Trust in New Zealand. So when we resigned from the New Zealand Trust, Robert Holmes of Court from Perth had died, and his widow Elizabeth and one of the trustees engaged me to look at Sherwin Pastoral, which was a big pastoral farming company that his family, the Court family, owned. And they asked me to do a similar exercise on that portfolio of farms as I had been doing for Kerry Packer on his farm. And that too was interesting. So during that next sort of 18-month period after 1990, I saw a lot more of Australia than I really would have ever imagined. But I was absent from home, and I wasn't sort of doing my fatherly duties at the school sports and the netball tournaments and things, and so it wasn't sustainable. So Lynn Williams and I formed a business called Agricultural Investments to do essentially the same things we'd done with the Rural Property Trust, but just in a very small way, so that it didn't grow too big and it didn't get too much attention, and we wouldn't advertise. We just worked by word of mouth, and so we did. And so I was able to spend a lot more time at home with the family, we'd consolidated our financial affairs by this stage, and we were enjoying Havelock life, having probably learned more about farming New Zealand than not too many other people at that stage. There wasn't too many roads that I hadn't been up or flown up, or farming families that I hadn't spoken to. About the trust.
Yes, I can imagine.
Because people were attracted to talk to us because we could find the keys to money. And so it was a very responsible job, but still plenty of time for sport, plenty of time for laughter, and joining the Backers Club and Rotary, another really enjoyable activity that hitherto I had absolutely no time for, because I was just somewhere else every day.
And, you know, during that period you had almost a commercial whitebaiting operation in the Fiordlands.
Well, not really commercial in the sense that we've never sold white paper, but but certainly, yes, it was about then, in the mid-1992, I think, was the first time. Flying around with Barry Gollum was a great experience. Mm. Barry's become a dear friend, but he's a good pilot. A bush pilot, but a good one.
Yeah.
So we'd be tuning off in our mall, hooning around, looking at farms up the top of the Rookaturi, and pedalling our way down through foggy sort of valleys, looking for such and such a station, and then up to Tulaga Bay to look at something else.
Yeah.
And
whoosh,
across to the back of Tauranga, and up at the Mamakus. Oh, we haven't got enough fuel, have a bit of stuff. So in amongst all this paddling around the bush flying, we were in Fiordland and stopped in a big bay to have a talk to a run holder down there who was freeholding his farm, his pastoral lease. And he invited us to stay for a couple of days in the hut, which we duly did. And in the first evening he picked up about 40 kilos of white bait in his net. Christ, this was pretty interesting. And to a couple of fishermen like us, or would-be fishermen, we thought, oh, we better stay another couple of days. And that's an experience that's continued ever since. We go down to Big Bay regularly. In fact, Barry and I and Bruce Stevenson, we're like migratory birds.
Yes, we've noticed.
At Labour weekend, we're gone for sort of a week or 2 weeks. Yeah, it's tons of fun.
Yes.
Barry goes flying. Stevie goes hunting. And in the early years, I took my tanks down. I'd have a bit of a dive, and there's a couple of wrecks there. We'll get some cranes or powers, or simply relax from all the travel that I'd been doing and people ringing me. You know, it was a nightmare. And to be released to somewhere where there was no power, no phone, no mail, no contact was just heaven. And to this day we still go back, and we subsequently bought a hut down there for the boys to do there in their time when they're a bit older, they can do the same things that we enjoy doing. But white painting's a great activity for a middle to late age of your life.
And it's a fairly short term season, isn't it? You don't have to be there all year.
No, it's the one fish species, Frank, that there is no regulation surrounding limits.
Mm.
You can catch as much as you like.
Yes.
You can sell it, although we never have sold a kilo of white bait, but everybody else does. And there's no quotas and no high-tech sort of regulation. So it's the West Coast is absolutely, it's a culture down there, the white bait.
Mm. And during this period in the 90s, you start preparing the section that this home stands on, and also you started accumulating native and hardwood and all sorts of timbers from all over New Zealand. You just might like to comment on that.
Yeah.
And the fact that you built a home that's so unique. Would it be?
Yes. This is yes. It was. It was from a temple at Delphi. We were travelling over there in 2001, and we were looking at some Greek ruins, and we're quite taken by the architecture of the ancient civilizations. Why was it this way? And why was it? And so we'll come back to that a little later.
Sure.
But certainly, I've always loved the bush, because I worked in the bush when I was young, cutting fungus. And so when we were doing, one of our career things we were involved with was trying to rescue AFCO. And that involved me travelling all around their plants and things, which at the time were being pulled down and scrapped. And here were these beautiful big carry beams and mattai boning rooms and things, all just being burned, trashed. So two of us bought a couple of wagon loads of cowrie and stuff from the freezer. It was actually the dairy company originally, built in 1908, up in in North Auckland, and we bought all the kauri and brought it home, dressed it all up, cleaned up. So what are we going to do with this? And it was about the time my father died, and his inheritance enabled me to build it, the bits that we now have at Mahia. So, yes, we had all this beautiful material, and so we built that building, which is quite unique in the amount of native wood that's in it. But I got quite fascinated. I was turning around looking at little defunct sawmills all around the North Island, down the West Coast, and talking to bushmen about how you do a cut this way and why you twisted that way. I remember tramping around up in the Coromandel Ranges looking for a hollowed out kauri log, which I found. And while I was looking at it, Jagger poked his head in the other end of it and said, "This is mine!" And here we were, 2 hours tramped from the nearest end of the road.
Is that right?
Yeah, true. Oh, it was funny. He was making spa pools. Out of these, and it's quite interesting. I didn't really have a use for it, so I said, "Oh, well, if you've got a use for it, go for it. I'll give you a hand to get it out." And which we later did. But yeah, they were fun times, accumulating all these different bits of wood. And then some years later, around about the year 2000, the family had sort of gone off overseas on their OE, first Sarah, and then Cameron, and then Richard. And so here we were living in Mr. Bell's old house, great big rambling old house. It was far too big for us, and it had a bit of land around it, and there was a section there that we thought, well, we'll keep that for ourselves and sell the house and sell the sections and build something that suits a couple of 60-year-olds. Mm. So we did that. We sold the old house and we rented a little house down the road. Didn't really know what we would build next, but I still have lots of this recycled timber. And we went off on a bit of an overseas trip just to sort of have a look at some architecture here, there and everywhere. And my first stop was New York. And I remember touring around New York and being impressed with all the skyscrapers and everything, and took a picture of the Twin Towers on the evening of the 5th of September 2001. And the next week then, just on sunset, I've still got that photo, it's got the date stamped on the bottom of the photo, and we flew down to Washington that evening and woke up in the morning to see the planes on television crashing into the Twin Towers that caught fire, and we were flying to Paris that morning, and I had to call into the Space Museum, NASA Space Museum, for Barry Golan asked me to get him a brochure on something or other. So we thought, God, this is pretty interesting, all this funny terrorism going on. Quite stunning, really. The whole town was stunned. So we were in the Space Museum and heard this big thump, and this, oh my God, a big Negro ushered us outside, and here was the plane that crashed into the Pentagon, the third aircraft, which was only about 250 yards away from where we were.
Yep, sure.
And the smoke billowing out of it all down Constitution Avenue. We were looking at the White House just literally 100 metres away.
Mm.
Thinking, Christ, this could be quite a dangerous place to be.
It could be.
But we better get out of the airport. So we went to get out of the airport, and the big Negro said, "I'm sorry, sir, you will be traveling that way." And within an hour of us coming out of that Space Museum, there was the most incredible array of military trucks and rocket launchers and radar equipment and all sorts of stuff filling up the street outside where we were to protect the White House and the Congress building. So we were kind of imprisoned. We got in a little local hotel. Because our flight obviously was all cancelled, everything was helicopters flying over the White House and jets over and above that. And next morning I thought, let's go along to Congress. This will be an interesting morning at Congress. And sure enough, right on the dot at 10 a.m., emergency meeting, President Bush stands up and announces, declares war, a formal declaration of war on terrorism and terrorists and Al-Qaeda, who they knew had done it. And that meant that all insurances in America were null and void, all sorts of things, a consequence of a declaration of war. However, and we watched mouths agape the next five pieces of legislation before we were chipped out. And then the first piece was pensions for all of the widows and widowers of the terrorist attacks. There was 5,000 odd people who had been killed. Their wives and husbands' pensions would be tax-free for the rest of their lives. That was the first piece of legislation. Second thing was passed seconds later, almost, that the Secretary of State asked for $18 billion, an unbelievable amount of money, for airport security throughout all 7,000 American airports or whatever it was. And Congress voted him double the amount, $38 billion. Well, I can't imagine that ever happening anywhere, but it happened. We saw it. And the next piece of legislation was just being debated when, once again, the big Negro comes in and ushers us out. You've had your 20 minutes, gentlemen, and off you go. So we did. And finally, later that week, we flew to Paris and we met the children and we had some time for them. And then on to Greece. And the archaeology that we had been wanting to look at. And we, I sort of almost immersed myself in it for sort of a week or 10 days, and looking at all these old temples and studying the Greek and the latterly, you know, the Romans really just copied the Greeks and robbed all that was the Greeks really, some would say the Greeks stole it off the Egyptians, who was the previous civilization, or the Minoans, but, and that may well be the case. But certainly what we learned there was that Greece, prior to the birth of Christ, when God was introduced as a single entity and everything had to point to God, that just changed the architecture forever. Prior to that point, God existed in all sorts of forms, in all sorts of the forest and the trees and the sea and the whatever. And in Greek mythology, a building was generally built for the senses of the person. So it was for your eyes and your ears and your nose and all that. That's really got it.
Yeah, true.
So I finally had a theme for this new house. What we would endeavour to do was to capture some of these rather strange but absolutely enduring qualities of architecture way beyond what has subsequently been sort of devised by mankind. And so, yeah, we did. So, we set about building the house we now live in and have for 14 years, and we just rejoice in its uniqueness. And it is very, very easy house to live in because of the acoustics and because the light is constant through the house and all sorts of aspects of it, which came home from the Temple of Delphi.
That's so interesting. And so, while you were doing this, you were still carrying on with your property development.
Farming?
Yes.
Yeah, farming investment. Agricultural investments,
yes.
Which began in 1990 when we resigned from the Rural Property Trust. We bought two or three farms, and then we bought a business called Dairy Brands, which was 18 farms. And there were some really interesting experiences in this because it was our first venture into big bizzo. And this was $32 million. And we'd never had something money like this before. And anyway, we had to get 12 million of equity. That's right. And the $18 million of debt. And we were buying out of China. It was a business, a collection of assortment of second-rate farms bought by Tom Kane and called Dairy Brands, trying to copy Tasman Agriculture, which had been done by Howard Patterson two years earlier, very successfully. This was a shoddy attempt. But however, we saw tremendous upside in the production of these farms, and while none of them really met our quality standards, we could see that we could double the equity investment in a period of 2 or 3 years. And to cut a long story short, with the help of Farmers Mutual, who invested $8 million, and a Sydney investor who invested $4 million, we did just that. And the share price was a public listed company, so we had experience now with a private trust, trust, our own private businesses, and now we were managing a public company listed on the stock exchange. And people were starting to look at us, and share price, we bought at 29.5 cents a share, and 34 months later, we wound the company up as a cash box with 74 cents a share. We had succeeded in doubling the shareholders' equity and paid a dividend as well. So it was something like a 74% return on capital, annualised.
Yes.
So we were sort of the bright boys of the financial world, albeit country yokels. And subject to a lot of jealousy when you get into a lot of greedy people exist at the top of the tree. You don't understand this when you just read the papers and you don't know them, but when you're actually living in that environment, greed becomes a much more apparent in the higher and financial circles you move. And didn't actually suit Lynn and I, because we were doing it because it was there to be done.
Yeah, sure.
And the success and the challenge and everything else, we weren't accumulators of money for our own well-being. At that stage in our lives, we were doing it because, hey, this is a bit of fun.
Yeah, sure.
Let's do it. Yeah, we can knock that off, kill it. Well, that entrepreneurialism got sort of captured by one or two. First of all, Jeff Jackson, who was the chief executive of AFCO, rang me one day and said, look, you're a bit entrepreneurial. I had previously become a director of Mount Linton and had some influence on that family business in Southland. And Jeff had been told by the banks that AFCO was what was the other English company that existed at the same time? Name escapes me, but one or other of them was going to be broke by the bank, was going to put one or other of them out of business within 90 days. And so we had a contract with AFCO to reshape their procurement. Prior to this, procurement for the freezing works as is today is all sort of done on a Sunday night over the telephone.
Yeah, sure.
And to cut a long story short, we develop pools, contracts, products whereby the company advanced money to farmers in exchange for a forward commitment of livestock.
Sure.
And it became very successful. Jeff built new plants to demonstrate that he could compete with Graham Lowe and Lowe Walker, who were building these $1 million plants and suddenly stealing market share off the bigger, older companies.
Yeah.
And so AFCO survived, and the other company, the English company, was put into receivership. And then AFCO was demutualised, which meant changing it from being a cooperative to a public company. And on that, the deal was done that if AFCO could raise $50 million, the bank would write off $100 million. And a team was put together, which included ourselves, and in fact, we were successful in raising $56 million. The bank wrote off its $100 million, and AFCO suddenly had the strongest balance sheet of any meat company in the country, which it had been prior to them, AFCO and Alliance, buying all the assets of Waitaki, that company that Ethel Hutton had built up, and they they all caught the flu when they bought that. It was a nightmare. All that spare capacity having to be unwound. And to cut a long story short, it was very successful for Agricultural Investments Limited, and Lynn and I were just left alone to think and devise strategies. And we turned livestock buyers who would hang over the sale yards with a cigarette in their mouth and a pencil and paper into contract salesmen selling procurement contracts, putting it straight into a tablet, registering it straight back. So suddenly the company had some structure. 74% of their bull kill was coming through a product called the number one bull pool, which we had devised the strategy for. Farmers loved it. Bankers loved it. It took all of that stocks and debtors off the AFCO balance sheet and put it into a separate pool account. It was good. And it was profitable for us. And then, so that was very successful, and that was followed by a contract from the wool board to do a similar thing. The wool industry was going through terrible stress and struggle at the time. The board had lost all credibility. The electoral college had been disposed of, and falling wool prices had consigned the industry. People were running around with their heads chopped off, not understanding what the future held.
Sure.
So we were engaged to look at the future. And I straight away started looking at the Irish linen industry, which went through a similar process prior to the First World War, and understood implicitly, I went on and had a look at it, and understood what happened to the flax producers, the actual linen factories, and the distribution network, and the products that were being replaced. And it was so obvious what was happening then, was happening now to wool with all of the competitive products in the carpet and the apparel industry. So to combat that, we came up with a strategy called Fernlink, which basically linked 103 export licenses. Can you believe that?
Yes, I could.
27 brokers, 16 wool scours. Oh, it was just a nightmare. A piece of wool changed hands about 8 or 10 times before it ever got spun into a product or weaved into a product. And the Fernlink was about creating a franchised system with the wool board as the franchisor. And the wool board at that stage still had 140 million and was capable of implementing this. It was adopted by the board. The chairman came home from England and unilaterally declared that they would not be going ahead with it, and sacked the chief executive. And that died stillborn, that idea. And the wool industry continued on its downward spiral, and the wool board chairman who instigated that was later seen to be an employee of Cavalier Carpets. So it was quite a... And of course it's a dead industry.
Now, because all the artificial partners have taken over.
That's right. Yeah. And not that our system could have arrested the trend of the market, but it certainly would have taken out all of the cost, and it would have meant you'd have